Accession number 18035, Reel 3.
Sort of floated off, I should imagine, didn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm. And there was usually, and I think waited until there was quite a reasonable breeze off the sea down the main runway, you see. Wharton tended to be a fairly breezy place at times. So, during these hops, incidentally, some of the locals were heard to say scathingly, they didn't think much of this lot at Wharton. They couldn't even get the aeroplane off the ground. But it did leave on Friday the 13th of May. We had offered to declare the aircraft unserviceable until a more auspicious date. But B said, it's as good a day as any. If it's ready, we'll go. So off he went. The engine situation was by no means a happy one at that stage, and one of the prototypes had been constructed with two means because of the doubts about the Avon, which was extremely prone to surge, was overweight, and the fuel consumption was higher than specified. But of course that all got sorted out in the end. Come the end of 1949, we had four prototypes flying from Wharton. One of them, as I've just mentioned, with Neen engines. By that time, the relationship between Arthur Sheffield and Teddy Petter had deteriorated considerably. Basically, Teddy Petter always wanted to run his own show, and I think had left Westlands because they'd been taken over by John Brown and so on, and he wasn't given as free a hand as he would have liked. Arthur Sheffield wasn't going to have anybody else messing about with his factory, so that caused problems. The upshot was that although I argued strongly with Teddy Petter that he ought to stay in between us, we could cope with the situation. And by that time, I was assistant chief engineer to Teddy Petter. And but I couldn't convince him, and from the end of 1949 he really never appeared in the factory again except to remove his stuff. He formally left, I think it was about February 1950, and I was appointed to take over from him from 1st of March 1950. That's where I met my schedule. Teddy Petter was, of course, a very good engineer. And again, a jolly good chap to work for. And I learnt a lot from him, and we and our two families became very friendly, which I'm happy to say continued after he left English Electric. Now, about this time, there was another major decision floating around Whitehall, which was that supersonics was all too difficult and expensive for the UK, So things like the Miles experimental aircraft and so on were cancelled. We thought that this was rather a good time to invest in supersonics, because we're in touch with what was going on experimentally in America, and there seemed to be considerable possibilities as a result of this. We developed the induction, the induced flow supersonic wind tunnel driven by a scrap Neen engine. That was very much the work of Di Ellis and his team, Di Ellis being the chief aerodynamicist.
What was the cross-sectional area of this tunnel?
I think that one was about 18 inches. Less than that. I think it was a foot. But of course, ultimately, not so long afterwards, we invested what was for them a huge sum of money in a big blowdown tunnel with a much bigger working section. And that is still operating and still providing very useful data on British aerospace aircraft. Again, we got an experimental contract, because again there were people in the Whitehall system who could see a bit further, and they could certainly let experimental contract. So we got an experimental contract for a supersonic aircraft. This eventually became the P1A with two Sapphire engines, and from the work on that, I should mention, by the way, the P1A was the first British aircraft to exceed the speed of sound in level flight. We heard the bang on the runway at Boscombe. From that followed the P1B, which was an aircraft with two Avons, and from that the Lightning.
Were the Sapphires an insurance against the Avons giving you further trouble, or why were they chosen for the first prototype?
Because they were, in fact, the best engine available at the time. The Avon went through a tremendous range of modifications, and the Avon that was eventually fitted to the Lightning was much more like the Sapphire than the original Avon, and more suitable for a supersonic aircraft. Ideally, we would have liked to have had a special supersonic engine, and we got some way along those lines in discussions with the Rolls-Royce engineering staff, but the Rolls-Royce management at the time weren't prepared to back a relatively new and inexperienced team to that extent at that time. A pity, because the UK might have had a better range of supersonic engines earlier. The Lightning, as you know, was developed via a development batch of aircraft and went into service at the end of 1959, early 1960, and remained in service for over 25 years. The Canberra's lasted
Still flying?
Yes. Over 40 years. Around about this time, the aviation activity was hived off into a separate aviation company within the English Electric Company. It became English Electric Aviation, which also embraced the then developing guided weapons outfit at Luton. Just to recap briefly on those two early aircraft of English Electric, the Canberra was licensed, built in America and in Australia, and of course the Australians were a very early customer, hence the name Canberra. There were enormous overseas sales of Canberra, and altogether something like 1,400 were produced. What is not often referred to is that it was the first aircraft, the first jet aircraft, to fly the Atlantic non-stop, and that it held the return flight London, New York, London, which it accomplished in 14 and a half hours, actually slightly under, and it held that for over 14 years. Altogether, it held 22 records and equipped 15 air forces. It held the absolute altitude record three times.
What was that figure? What was the altitude?
The final one was something like 73,000 feet plus. That was using a rocket booster in the Bombay, and that was based on a PR-7 airframe. And the pilot was Mike Randrum, who was one of our early managers after he retired from test flying.
Because he was with Napier's at one time, wasn't he?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a Napier rocket booster. It was used. And of course, in Saudi Arabia, he was associated with the Lightning, because the Lightning was the basis for the contracts in Saudi Arabia. There have been a succession of contracts with Saudi Arabia, as you know. The latest is a simply enormous one involving Tornados and Hawks. But all that business, which runs into many billions of pounds, started because we had Lightnings to sell. The Saudis wanted a supersonic aircraft. They didn't want to be entirely dependent on the Americans. And had we believed that there would not be any future in supersonics, none of that business would have been obtained. The Saudi story is a tremendous one and really deserves a tale in its own right.
You were involved personally in the negotiations?
Oh, yes. In fact, I think I first visited Saudi Arabia around about 1964. That was when Jim Dell, by arrangement, borrowed a Lightning from a formation which was doing an exercise out to Singapore, staging via Bahrain, Jim Dell picked one up, flew it into Riyadh, and we took our own control equipment into Riyadh, and I can show you a picture of us sitting with Prince Sultan watching Jim Dell's demonstration.
Wow.
And contrary to the attitude here, which was that if you did have to fly supersonic, you had to do it out over the sea, which is imposing a tremendous burden on the chaps who fly these aeroplanes. Jim Dell was a bit taken aback when he was asked to prove that it was supersonic by depositing a bang on the airfield, which he promptly did very well.
The single seater,
it was a single seater.
Yeah, you couldn't take anyone for a ride.
No. But then subsequently after that, there was a proper evaluation with the Saudis. We were, in fact, in competition with the Lockheed Starfighter. In the same way that the Canberra had been in competition with at least two other American aircraft for the American Canberra contract. And then things went on from there. The Saudi contract based on the Lightning, but involving very much more, was signed in 1966. At that time, it was the largest export contract ever obtained by any British consortium. It was a consortium arrangement because radar and support was involved. Ultimately, BAC, as it then was, took over the whole thing because the customer decided that we could run it more satisfactorily than anybody else. And from that stage, things never looked back.
Where did their pilots get trained? In this country, or were they trained out there?
Some key pilots were trained in this country in a splendid joint operation between BAC and the Royal Air Force. There was a great deal of government cooperation throughout. And of course, part of the buy included strike masters. So they were trained on small propeller aircraft, the strike masters, then Northrop F5s, and then Lightnings. And most of the training of most of the pilots was done in Saudi Arabia. And it all ended up as an extremely professional operation. And many of the Saudi pilots were extremely good and extremely keen. And of course, we were responsible for setting up and operating technical training facilities, electronic facilities, and so on. And there was a good deal of cooperation with the American teams in Saudi Arabia, too. I mentioned British Aircraft Corporation. Of course, British Aircraft Corporation was formed in the latter half of 1960 with the TSR-2 used as welding flux. Initially, it was a simple transfer of ownership to a holding company. Now, it's quite wrong for the aircraft to use an aircraft specification and a contract as welding flux for an industrial reorganisation. A lot has been written about the subject, and there's no point in my repeating it. I think it would have been better if the original English Electric proposal for a simpler and cheaper aeroplane had been accepted.
Where did the design originate then, from Weybridge?
No, there were two competing designs. One from, well, there were at least two from Weybridge. There were about three, certainly, from Wharton. But the one at Wharton finalised as a smaller, a cheaper, less elaborately equipped aircraft. The idea being that you could up both the performance and the equipment by progressive development. And generally that is the cheapest way of doing it. Midlife updates and things like that are in fact now standard practice. And this was a lesson that we had learned on the Canberra, which is why we tackled it that way on the Wharton proposals. But of course, in the competition between English Electric and Vickers, because we were competing, the customer used every trick in the book to try and up the bid. Which I think at least helped to cause the final problems with the TSR-2.
The specification of the TSR-2, was it essentially a low-level supersonic Canberra, or was it a totally different concept? I mean, it was mainly designed for low-level, was it, or what was the specification?
It was basically designed as a low-level penetration and strike and reconnaissance aircraft, hence the name, TSR. Mm-hmm. But it was specified to have a Mark II operational speed at altitude. So it was a very flexible aeroplane. But the key design point was and here I'm speaking from memory, 1,000 nautical miles at the lowest possible level. And you're talking there in terms of 200 feet rather than 2,000.
Real fuel guzzling stuff, in other words.
Oh yes, yes. Mm.
How did it compare with altitude, say with the Vulcan, on operational range? Similar?
In terms of range, it would have been similar, but of course the speed range was different.
Mm.
The Vulcan at altitude cruising subsonic would of course have had a significantly longer range. Because the Vulcan design point originally was a high altitude cruise like the Canberra. And under those conditions, the Vulcan would certainly have had a longer range. The original contract for TSR 2 was in fact awarded to Vickers with the instruction that 50% had to be shared with Wharton. With the development of BAC, which over the subsequent years altered from a simple transfer of ownership to a holding company to an integrated operating company, then of course it was a BAC contract. It was a joint team operating, and as you know, the aircraft itself was an extremely successful and promising aircraft, insofar as you could judge on one prototype flying. The cancellation action, as has been recorded, was totally ruthless. We did suggest that the one prototype that was flying, plus two others which were ready to go, should be used in a supersonic research program, which could have been of great value to this country. But that was refused, and to make sure the aircraft were well and truly grounded, the jigs were broken up, and that was that. This left quite a few problems, but by rearranging things within BAC and based on the developing Saudi program, the initiation of the Jaguar in the period from 1965 onwards, and the transfer of the Jetprov Strike Master operation to Wharton, which was sensible as the Strike Master was the basis of part of the Saudi contract. The BAC managed to weather the storm. This was the period, of course, when Sir George Edwards did a great deal of tramping of the corridors of power in Whitehall. All kinds of things were going on. There was the Plowden Committee, you remember. I became involved in the later stages in 67, 69 in the Elstub Committee, examining the efficiency of the aerospace industry and so on. Towards the end of this period, Panavia was formed, and by that time the Anglo-French variable geometry aircraft, of course, had been cancelled several years before, and the multi-role combat aircraft had been a basis for discussion between about five or six nations. Uh,
ultimately, this boiled down to three: Germany, Italy, and the UK. We would like to have involved the French, but the French way of operating was so different from that envisaged by the partners that it was quite impossible.
You couldn't build on any experience from the Jaguar program then, because that, you cooperated satisfactorily with them on that one, didn't you?
Yes, but